All rise. The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit is now in session. All persons having business before this honorable court may now draw near and they will be heard. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated.
It's a great honor and a pleasure for us to be here with you today. And I'd like to thank Dean Lindquist and his school for inviting us to join you. We have three cases for argument today. Ms. Bindler, would you announce the docket?
Yes, Your Honor. The following cases are set today for this special sitting on April 15th, 2026 at this special sitting at Washington University. Number 25-1877 from the Eastern District of Missouri, Ginger Headley et al. Versus Boshko Ognanovsky et al. The second case is number 25-3159 from the Western District of Missouri, Revenue Management Solutions versus Commerce Bank. The third case is number 25-2313 from the Northern District of Iowa, United States versus Todd Sutton Jr. The first case for argument is Ginger Headley versus Boshko Ognanovsky.
Closing.
Good morning, Your Honors. Louis Capozzi, Solicitor General of Missouri, on behalf of the appellants. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court. This case features an unfortunate accident, Corey Kofelt's suicide at the Moberly Correctional Center. Appellees are trying to hold a variety of parties responsible for that suicide, including the five prison guards at issue in this appeal. But appellees' two claims cannot proceed against the prison guards. Qualified immunity bars the Eighth Amendment claim, and Missouri's official immunity doctrine bars the negligence claim. In both cases, there are binding precedents that are all but directly on point. The court should reverse. Unless otherwise instructed, I'll start with the Eighth Amendment claim. All agree that appellee must plead facts showing that the prison guards were aware of an obvious suicide risk. But the complaint simply does not do that. The complaint alleges only three facts even arguably relevant to the prison guard's knowledge. First, the officers saw Kofelt being quiet when entering segregated confinement. Second, Kofelt had been put in segregated confinement based on, quote, an urgent need to separate the offender from others for her own safety or that of others and for the security and good order of the institution, end quote. And three, the medical professional who had just examined Kofelt found he was not a suicide risk immediately before placing him in segregated confinement. These allegations come nowhere close to pleading.
Other factual allegations about the not checking on him,
So there is an allegation that Moberly had a policy requiring checks every 20 minutes or three times per hour. I'm not sure that that's relevant to the question of whether they were aware of a suicide risk. I think if anything, that would go to the second inquiry in a case like this, which is whether the guards sort of recklessly responded to a suicide risk. But at the threshold, you have to show, you have to plead facts showing that the prison guards are aware that they know about an obvious suicide risk.
What about the medical records that indicated three prior attempts?
So there's no allegation in the complaint that the prison guards knew what was in those medical records. And I think this court's decision in Whitney versus City of St. Louis is on point. There, the court reviewed a motion to dismiss, very similar case. And the court found qualified immunity and noted that there was no allegation that the information in the files was actually relayed to the prison guards. And the same is true here. There's no allegation that the information in the files was actually relayed. And in fact, the complaint pleads that the prison guards did not review the files, but there's no authority from this court suggesting that it violates the Eighth Amendment for a prison guard not to review the medical files. Might be different if you're a medical professional actually examining a prisoner. And there are claims against the medical professionals in this case, but they are not at issue on this appeal. They're still before the district.
Well, the other side said in the reply brief that was you that was saying it. Well, so what do you think of the Relegant case?
Of the, I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The Relegant, R-E-L-L-E-R-G-E-N-T case? It's in your brief.
Yes, so that was one of this court's earliest cases, I think setting the standard that the prison, you have to plead that the prison guards are aware of an obvious suicide risk, and the court there found qualified immunity, but I think that sets the standard that—
How close are the facts of that case? That's what I was trying to drive.
I think they're pretty similar. I don't remember all of the facts, but I remember that in that case, the court found qualified immunity, and I don't think there were sufficient allegations of knowledge. And I think the court also addressed the second prong, which is whether the guards responded appropriately to a risk they were aware of. So going back to what the complaint alleges, there are three relevant factual allegations as discussed, and they just don't come anywhere close to pleading the relevant standard. In Hott v. Hennepin County, this court said that a prisoner's glum demeanor does not put prison guards on notice of a suicide risk. And the order putting Kofelt in segregated confinement was highly ambiguous. It refers to Kofelt being a risk to himself or others. Thus, the prison guards could have understood Kofelt to be confined, for example, to avoid a potential fight with other inmates. But this is an especially easy case because the complaint acknowledges that a medical professional, LPN Huff, who's not a party in this appeal, found that Kofelt was not a suicide risk right before he was placed in segregated confinement. Ellie's acknowledged that at page 21 of their brief and at paragraph 36 of their complaint. And the court addressed a practically identical case in Perry v. Adams, where this court reversed the denial of qualified immunity because the prisoner, quote, was analyzed by a mental health professional and was on a watch status indicating he was not suicidal, end quote. That's this case to a T.
Well, is that really true? Weren't there repetitive complaints by Kofelt that he was suffering from depression, anxiety, psychosis? He reported visual hallucinations. He reported seeing death angels. He reportedly, the allegation is that he made those to a number of personnel, which may or may not include the officers, right? And so if you put all that together, there's an argument that can be advanced. Even that's just enough to say that, well, they were on notice that he was suffering from a severe psychosis, and he had a history of three prior suicide attempts. Now, what each individual guard knew, that's I get where that argument is. But, I mean, it does strike me that there is some evidence here that does suggest that the guards should have been aware that he was in a fragile state.
Well, I think this goes back to this court's decision in Whitney, because there were similar allegations there, including a previous suicide attempt, and it's in the medical files. But as in Whitney, there's no allegation here that that information was relayed to the guards. The complaint alleges that that information, which you just discussed, his prior suicide attempts, his visions, his mental health issues, were relayed to the medical professionals, the psychiatrist and the LPN, who are defendants in this case, but they're not parties in this appeal. And so really, I think this appeal is about, you know, who can plausibly be held responsible based on the face of the complaint. And at least with respect to the prison guards, there's no allegation that they knew any of the stuff that you just mentioned, which really puts this case on all fours with Whitney.
What about the allegations that he was chronically sleep deprived and was unable to sleep in a prison environment? Obviously, the guards would have been the people that would have been able to observe that, at least in theory. I assume that, you know, while this guy's in custody, he's being monitored.
Well, there's no allegation that they were aware of sleep issues. And I'm not sure sleep issues by themselves, even assuming the guards did know about that or they had observed that, even though that's not pleaded. But even assuming that it was pleaded, I don't think that would be enough to put someone on notice of a suicide risk. You know, a lot of people have issues sleeping, lawyers probably top of the list. Again, there's no allegation in the complaint that the guards were aware of that. I also want to point out that appellees rely a lot on factual allegations that aren't in the complaint. We addressed this on pages 13 to 14 of our reply brief. These allegations include that Kofelt, you know, had sought attention for several hours, that he was screaming, that he asked for a pen, and that one of the guards told him he did not need a pen. Obviously, appellees cannot save a defective complaint by asserting new facts on appeal, and so we would ask the court not to consider those facts and just to stick to what's in the complaint. And again, what's actually in the complaint is quite threadbare and really on all fours with what this court considered in Whitney. Finally, appellees fault the prison guards for not checking Kofelt's cell for about an hour prior to his death in violation of the prison's policy. But that allegation does not suggest that the guards were aware of a suicide risk. And so it's really not relevant to the question on appeal. And in any event, you know, cases like Luckert, this court has said that failing to follow the prison rules does not violate the Eighth Amendment.
On the official immunity question, why isn't the failure to check a very ministerial duty?
I'm happy to turn now to official immunity. So under Missouri official immunity doctrine, the ministerial exception is very narrow. This court and the Missouri Supreme Court have repeatedly and emphatically made that clear. And I think that this case is relatively straightforward, looking at the Missouri Supreme Court's decision in Cunningham and especially Morales. So in Cunningham, we get the governing test, which is an act is not ministerial if an official exercises, quote, any discretion, even slight discretion, end quote, in performing the duty in the case. And I think Morales tells us just how demanding this is. The facts there in Morales are quite difficult. You know, it's a state medical center, and the state had a care policy for Ronald Scheer, a resident. The care policy required the staff to check on him every 30 minutes, every 2 hours, and to provide 24-hour supervision. It required them to reposition him and check his incontinence pad every 2 hours. And it was undisputed the staff violated all of those policies. They didn't check on him at all for over 2 hours, and he died during that time. But despite those difficult facts, the Missouri Supreme Court found that official immunity applied. The court found that there was some discretion in who did the checks and how the checks were carried out. And it said that's enough discretion. And the court acknowledged that the ministerial exception is extremely narrow. The court described it as only applying to rubber stamp acts, you know, maybe like stamping a document. It's a very, very narrow exception to official immunity. And Morales really does make this a fortiori case. You know, whereas the policy in Morales unambiguously required checks at particular times, every 30 minutes, every 2 hours, the guards here actually had more discretion as to timing. They could check every 20 minutes or three times per hour. So that's just a
complaint. Say they didn't check for a period of 3 hours, or is that one of the items that are in some of the other?
The complaint says that they didn't check for about an hour. 3 hours comes from the new facts that are not.
Is that that investigative report that goes all around everything?
Yes. So it's not in the complaint. What's in the complaint is 1 hour.
Department of Corrections supplemental report on employee conduct that I'm referring to.
So that report was disclosed during discovery in response to a subpoena in this case, and you know there shouldn't be discovery. The case should have been dismissed. So we would ask the court not to rely on that. Those allegations aren't.
There's no pending motion to amend, right, of any kind?
No, Your Honor.
Has any motion amendment made at any time?
I don't. So plaintiffs have already filed four complaints in this case, so they're on their third amended complaint. I don't believe there's currently a motion to amend, but they have amended before.
Our Letterman case kind of goes the opposite way on this question of whether it's ministerial. And I know you're saying, well, the Missouri cases are tighter than that. But what would be left of the ministerial exception? It can't just be stamping documents or something that routine, can it?
I mean, that's what the Missouri Supreme Court said. I think that some of this court's older cases predate Morales and predate Cunningham, and I think those cases really emphatically tighten the standard for the ministerial exception. And the Missouri Supreme Court's been candid about this, and you know the state, or we described this doctrine as stingy in our brief, and that's because the Missouri Supreme Court intends it to be stingy. They want broad protection for public officials performing their duties, and that's a policy choice that we think that this court should respect. And the court, the Missouri Supreme Court did describe it as effectively only applying to rubber stamp acts. And so, again, I don't see how the other side can distinguish the Morales case. It really is on all four with this one.
Posey, did you want to reserve some time?
Yes, I will reserve. Thank you, Your Honor.
Morning, Mr. Bishop.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Stephen Bishop on behalf of appellees Ginger Kofelt and Mark Kofelt and Ginger Headley, appellees in this case, natural parents of decedent Corey Kofelt. We are here today asking this court to affirm the district court's ruling denying defendants qualified and official immunity. This appeal only asks whether at the 12B6 stage, plaintiffs sufficiently alleged deliberate indifference and that defendants violated or were performing a ministerial duty or not performing when they failed to perform their cell checks that were mandated at least once every 20 minutes. We believe that plaintiffs have done that.
Or three times an hour, right?
I don't believe it said that in the-
Or, doesn't it?
I don't believe so.
I thought it had an or right in the phrase.
If it does, I believe it was just clarifying there were three in an hour, but I don't think there's an or. Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
I think you're right, by the way, three. I misspoke, go ahead.
We believe we have sufficiently made those allegations. I will first address the standard of review, followed by qualified immunity and then official immunity. At the 12B6 interlocutory appeal stage, the court applies de novo review. The court must accept all well-pled facts as true and draw reasonable inferences in favor of plaintiff. To survive a 12B6 motion, the complaint must contain sufficient factual matter accepted as true to state a claim to relief that is plausible on its face. Plausibility requires well-pled facts that allow the court to draw reasonable inferences to support a right to relief. Legal conclusions and elements of claims do not suffice. The facts must not be painstakingly detailed, but must give a right to relief beyond speculation. Here, plaintiffs have done that. The Dantzler court stated, in the interlocutory appeal posture, the court takes as true the facts that the district court found were adequately supported, as well as the facts the district court likely assumed.
I think the strongest piece of evidence that you have is the medical record showing three prior attempts. But as I understand it, it wasn't pled that these two officers were aware of that. Is it a reasonable inference that these two officers would have had access to and read his prior medical records?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And 2 points on that. First, we do allege that. We do. In paragraphs 45 and 46, we state that Mr. Kofelt made several complaints and requests to defendants during his incarceration regarding his need for mental health help, medication, hallucinations, lack of sleep, depression, anxiety, and psychosis. So
that has nothing about the medical records reflecting the three prior attempts or that he told them that he had made three prior attempts or anything like that.
I believe it also mentions the three prior attempts. I think I misspoke. Sorry. I believe it says
his, read there didn't say that.
You're correct. And I believe in the complaint, it does say.
You have the complaint handy?
I actually don't. I apologize. Proceed. I was looking for it when I was sitting there, but I don't. Okay.
Proceed.
But I believe that's in there. Because this is similar to the Brenner v. Asfeld case, where they did, unlike the Whitney case that appellants mentioned, in that case, there was a medical examiner record that mentioned that the inmate was suicidal, but it was never relayed to the actual defendant. In Brenner v. Asfeld, they distinguished it because they had stated that they had made those allegations against all defendants. And we make the exact same type of allegation as in Brenner in 45 and 46 of our complaint. Going back on the standard of review, the court has jurisdiction to only determine legal issues and not weigh factual disputes or weigh evidence. And appellees would argue that that is what appellant's argument asked this court to do. And at this stage, we believe the allegations as we pled them are sufficient. On the qualified immunity claim, with the allegations taken as true, plaintiffs have sufficiently pled deliberate indifference. To show deliberate indifference in the jail suicide context, you must show that the officers had actual knowledge of a substantial risk and that they failed to take any reasonable measures to abate that risk. Knowledge can be proven through circumstantial evidence. While obviousness of the risk is not the ultimate inquiry, it may serve as circumstantial evidence. Here, plaintiffs have not only pled actual knowledge, they've also made allegations that state that the risk was so obvious that they would have known and that the court should be able to draw that reasonable inference from the allegations.
Those are conclusions. What are your best facts that say that they're aware of that are pled?
We plead that they were aware. We plead that. Well,
but that's a conclusion. What facts support that are pled?
That they had a duty to have a heightened security on.
Well, a duty isn't a fact that puts them on notice. What's a fact? What are the facts?
That Mr. Kofelt was in immediate risk of harm to himself, so he was in administrative segregation. That he made complaints of seeing death angels and having hallucinations and having psychosis.
Those things in the complaint, the seeing death angels and that sort of thing?
Yes.
Okay. That's, as I read the complaint, that is actually pled. But it is never ever pled that the defendants were aware of that. It's just that, looking at the allegation, it really is just in there as sort of like, these things were known, and they're specifically said to be known to Eddie, but then not specifically to the other defendants. And so that's the real question, I think, at this point that's been raised, is that what actual knowledge did the officer defendants have, and I don't know, as you read the complaint, it's hard to find any specific allegation that they had knowledge and how they came to that knowledge, right? And so then you're left in the land as well. Do you draw an inference? And so
seems to me the argument you're making is that the inference can be drawn because he's been put into administrative segregation for his safety and the safety of others, that they do have general awareness in the institution as to his psychotic incidents and complaints, and the medical records show that the that he's had three prior suicide attempts, right?
Correct.
And from that, you should be able to infer that the officers have knowledge, you claim.
Correct.
Okay. But it's not specifically alleged anywhere that the officers had that knowledge?
And I may be wrong, but I believe I'm correct that in paragraphs 45 and 46 would encapsulate it. Now, that doesn't mention the death angel as specifically.
No, but it does specifically say audio and visual hallucination.
Correct. So I think there is a paragraph that encapsulates that, and it applies to all defendants, and I think it's in the section for facts that apply to all counts.
Yeah, and then what you allege in 46 is that the defendants were aware that the decedent had an objectively serious mental health need, as it was obvious based on his condition and the decedent's prior records, right? That's the allegation.
Yep.
And you're saying all the defendants knew that. And then that question is just what Judge Grunder said. That sounds like a conclusion rather than a factual allegation. Are we wrong? I assume you think we're wrong. And my question is why?
I guess you may be right. You may be wrong. I would argue that it isn't a conclusion, but I would say if it is, then the reasonable inference drawn in plaintiff's favor shows that they did have knowledge.
What large an institution is this? Is that the complaint or in the record?
It is not.
Yeah. And, you know, and the reason I ask that question is obviously you're sitting in a small county jail in pick a small town in Missouri, because I would just say in my hometown of Rugby, North Dakota, you know, everybody knows who's in the jail, why they're in there, and there's no medical record that's secret once it's in the jail, right? If it's that kind of a jail, it's much easier to draw the inference that these guys have to know. But if this is a larger institution, it's a little bit tougher to say, well, it was in the medical records. I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean, if you've got a jail that's got a population on the average day of 20 people, they probably mentioned that Joe, by the way, over here has had multiple suicide attempts. That's less likely if it's a facility with 400 people in it.
Correct. I would say it's closer to the 20 people than it is to the 400. I don't think it's quite 20, but it's a small jail. It's like the local Moberly Correctional Center, I would say. Lastly, on qualified immunity, we believe that we pled they had knowledge. And then regarding the fact that he wasn't put on suicide watch, we think when you take plaintiff's allegations as true, that just makes the fact that he wasn't put on suicide watch that much more deliberately indifferent. At this stage, there's don't know without discovery.
Wouldn't that have been a call of the medical people?
I think it could go to either.
Is there an allegation that decision is made by these particular officers? Whether he should be on suicide watch.
Say that again.
The question of whether he should be on suicide watch, is that pled that decision would be made by these particular officers, or is that a medical decision?
I don't know that it's pled, but I believe we allege that any of them could have done that, that they all have that authority. So we would argue that they didn't do anything to abate the risk. They left him with a sheet, knowing of his prior suicide attempts, and then they didn't check on him at all. So they did less than the bare minimum. So nothing reasonable to abate the risk. There's no further questions. I'd like to move on to official immunity. Regarding official immunity, plaintiffs must sufficiently plead that defendants performed a ministerial act with no discretion as to when or how to perform that act, or that they didn't perform the act. In this case, they didn't. Ministerial duty is clerical. As appellants said, it's often considered a rubber stamp duty. The current test is if there's any discretion whatsoever as to when or how to perform the act, the act or action is discretionary. We would argue that the court should adapt a test similar to the one in Williams v. Department of Corrections.
Now, aren't we bound by Missouri law and the Missouri Supreme Court on this? They've ruled on it three or four times in the last three or four years.
While you should take that into consideration, no, not if you believe it's the wrong, that the court reached the wrong decision.
Wait a minute. Isn't the final arbiter of Missouri law the Missouri Supreme Court? And aren't we bound by what they have to say? I mean, I don't believe that I'd like to know what the argument is that says that we may substitute our notion of what the Missouri law is for what the Missouri court says it is.
I think that the issue with the current test is that when you say that an act can't be discretionary as to how or when it can be done, I think any act has discretion, even a stamp. I mean, you could stamp it with your left hand or your right hand. You could stamp it from left to right. You could put your hand on it and press down. So I just don't think the test is.
Well, it seems like the government wants to expand it's not enough for them, because they say if who is added to that, it's not just like when and how, but they say who as well as part of that discretion. So they're saying, you know, if you don't say who's got to do it, when they've got to do it, and how they're supposed to do it, that it's no longer ministerial. That's their argument, right? Why are they wrong? Looking at Morales in particular.
At this stage, I would say one, because at this stage of litigation, we don't know exactly all the ins and outs of the duty, and determining ministerial or discretionary does require.
The district court, though, it relies entirely on the failure to check. I just looked at it, both in the legal discussion and in the bare facts. That's all that we have, right? Is the failure to check.
Yes, then failure to.
That's all that's on those pages, not anything else.
Yeah, they need to perform at least one check every 20 minutes. So
three times an hour.
Yeah. So,
and by the way, the district court doesn't mention the over three times an hour. You're aware of that, I bet.
Yeah, I don't know that we did necessarily, but we would argue there's no discretion as to how or when three times per hour.
Yeah, that or three times an hour is actually from your complaint, because it says three times an hour, comma, or every 20 minutes, you know, and that's the allegation. Looks like the judge actually made the finding that the policy was three times an hour, and
right,
you know, and I'm not sure that's the hill that everybody's going to die on, but the question and the argument is advanced that the problem is that by its very nature, three times an hour involves some discretion, and it's too much discretion to be ministerial. Why are they wrong?
I don't think it was meant to say once. So I don't think it means you could check on them three times in the first 10 minutes and then you'd be good for the hour. What it's saying is at least once every 20 minutes equals three times in an hour. So there's no discretion as to how or when.
One other question. Mr. Capozzi suggested we give you the opportunity to distinguish Morales. Can you do that?
Yes. One second. In Morales, that was the severely disabled individual. The policies were an individual support plan, and the people in charge of that individual, I believe, had to readjust him, fasten his pelvic harness, check his incontinence pad, and the court determined that all of those things are discretionary and require a degree of professionalism that's above cleric.
Your point this is just a look in and that's it.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have, like, if you reposition someone, how are you going to reposition them? This is just lay eyes on them at least once every 20 minutes.
I understand your argument. Your time has expired. Thank you, Mr. Bishop.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Capozzi, your rebuttal.
Quick points, Your Honors. Paragraph 40 of the complaint does say every 20 minutes or three times per hour. But it doesn't actually matter that much because in Morales, the policy was check every 30 minutes, period. And even that was not ministerial, according to Morales. So I haven't heard a...
What about this argument that somehow Morales, that there was a whole series of tasks that needed to be performed, and in this case, all you've got is put eyes on them. And it doesn't even say you got to see them personally, right? I mean, it just says you have to check on them. So theoretically, maybe you could do that by video or something.
There's more discretion here. Yeah, it's how you do the check, how you interact with the person, when you do the check. You know, in Morales, the Missouri Supreme Court marched through the four parts of the individual support plan, including the requirements to check at designated times, and said, this is still ministerial. Your Honor asked, you know, where does the who is doing it prong of the ministerial test come from? That comes from Morales and from Love. The Missouri Supreme Court itself said that when there's discretion as to who performs the task, that it can't be ministerial. So we're just taking that from there. On the question of the medical records, paragraph 69 of the complaint, which I have, specifically says that the officers, quote, failed to review decedent's prior records. It also says that defendants failed to note decedent's prior suicide attempts. That is paragraph 69. And so you have an allegation that they didn't look at the records, which makes this case actually even easier than Whitney, where there was merely a failure to allege. Here there's a allegation that they didn't look at the records. Unless the court has further questions, we would ask the court to reverse.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Court appreciates both counsel's appearance and coming here to Washington University and being willing to make your arguments here in this court. Case is submitted, and we will issue an opinion in due course. You may be excused. Ms. Bindler, I think I neglected to ask you to announce the first case, but would you announce our second case for argument?
Your Honor. The second case called for argument is revenue management.